tear.
You brought up Silver, Sophie said. Why?
Ventress didn't send us to provoke the island over him. Too big a risk.
No, he said. My understanding is that Silver has a very strong interest in you. Can you tell me about that?
She looked at Asano, lounging casually in the chair, not knowing what to make of him. She didn't recognize where he was from, ethnically speaking. His skin was lighter than the local humans, and much lighter than hers. His features were a little too sharp to be handsome, but his short hair had an appealingly silky luster. He waited patiently for her to respond, as if he didn't have a care in the world, which she was confident wasn't the case. This had to be a big deal for him. He might seem casual and in control, but he wanted something from this conversation, leading her to his objective like a heidel to water. She decided to let him, for now. If she knew what he was after, she might find some leverage, or at least learn some things along the way.
Silver and I kind of grew up together, she told him. My father worked for his. He wanted what all young men want, but I very much didn't. His father indulged him too much, which had turned him into a little dictator.
I know the type, he said. Insecure about their power, they become fixated on obtaining or destroying anything that challenges it.
Exactly. He wasn't used to hearing no, but his father protected me.
Until his father died.
That was when we sought out Ventress for protection. It was fine at first. Then she had me fighting in the pits to provoke Silver into doing something stupid. I could live with that. Then came this. Stealing from the wealthy and powerful. You said you knew why.
It's interesting, he told her. The story you just told me has been playing out again, but with bigger stakes. The reason I asked about Lucian Lamprey is that he was the one that prompted Ventress to send you off thieving. Like Silver, Lamprey took an interest in you, but Ventress had promised to protect you.
Reputation means everything to her, Sophie said.
That's why she sent you off on jobs that would get you caught. Once you were in the system and out of her reach, Lamprey could swoop in using his own influence and get his hands on you. The problem is, Lamprey turned out to be very much of a type with Silver. He isn't used to being told no, and you became the symbol of his denial. As time moved on, his inability to have you became an obsession, leading him to increasingly pressure Ventress. You seem to attract a certain kind of man, unfortunately.
We were hiding from Ventress. She was quietly trying to find us, even while publicly we were under her protection. Even her reputation won't matter if someone that powerful is bearing down on her. But what you said about the story repeating itself. Someone wants to provoke Lamprey, the way Ventress was provoking Silver?
Yes.
Who?
I'm not going to tell you that. Sophie fell silent as she thought it over.
Dorgan, she concluded. That wasn't the first time someone has interfered to help me get away. Those people who attacked you at the docks had to be his. Ventress or Silver's people would have gone for me, not you. That was because they wanted me to not get caught, so Lamprey would keep stressing.
Yes.
Whoever it was had to know who we are and what we're doing. Someone from the island using Dorgan's people as a cutout to keep their hands clean.
Yes.
So all that we did, our plan, we were just dancing in the hand of some rich prick on the island.
Yes.
But you messed that up. And now I'm going exactly where Lamprey and Ventress wanted from the start.
Not exactly, he said.
Are you joking? You think I don't know how this goes? I'm sentenced to indenture, except instead of getting auctioned off, the court makes a deal to hand me over to an upstanding member of the community.
That's where I intervene, he said. I can't stop the indenture, but I've recently been reading the agreement between the city and the Adventure Society. One of the rules, tucked away in the small print, is that anyone who completes the contract gets right of refusal on anyone sentenced to indenture as a result of that contract.
So I end up in your hands, instead of Lamprey's.
Yes.
How do I know that's any better?
You don't. I could be making all this up to manipulate you into quietly capitulating to my arrangements.
She stared at him, and he gave her a friendly smile in return. They sat in silence while she thought things over. Why?
She asked, finally. Why what?
Why take my indenture? Won't that pit you against Lamprey?
Yes.
You work for the person who wants to provoke him, don't you?
If that were the case, I wouldn't have caught you at all.
You say that, but there could be plenty of reasons. Those people they sent to interfere, they didn't seem to stop you. That might just be cover. They were afraid mine and Belinda's plan might actually work, or maybe that we'd get caught carrying it out. So they send you to catch me and still keep me out of Lamprey's hands.
He smiled. That makes sense, he said. Assuming that anything I've told you is true, Lamprey may not be involved at all. There may be no mysterious figure from the island, masterminding events. We may not have your friend upstairs, and this might not even be Jory's clinic. Have you been inside since the renovations? This could all be a game I'm playing. The man with lascivious intentions could be me.
Then why bother with all this?
Who knows? Maybe I need you to go along with my plot due to some nuance of local laws that would put you in my power. Maybe I'm just a twisted maniac who likes to play with his food.
I told you in the beginning that you aren't in control of what happens next. I'm starting to think you're twisted, whatever the truth is,
she told him. He chuckled. Quite probably, he said, and stood up. I'll go get your friend. You can talk things over. He opened the door and left. Then it opened again immediately, and he stuck his head back in. Please don't try to break out. Chapter 106. Something Shady. Jory's kitchen table was covered in magic diagrams, with Belinda taking Clive through how they worked.
Obviously, the lock is impervious to ordinary intrusion, she explained. I resequence the magical bursts into an irregular pattern. It doesn't throw off any individual element, but
it accumulates small errors that cause the whole thing to break down.
Clive finished.
That's brilliant.
How did you come up with that? I was working on something a while back. I was stuck using low-quality sequencing rods, and I didn't realize what was happening until the misalignment crashed the whole rig. I came up with this while troubleshooting.
Brilliant, Clive said. Adversity driving innovation.
Jory's assistant, Janice, knocked on the door as she came in.
Mr. Asano says she's awake. You can go and see your friend now.
They all went back downstairs, Janice heading back to reception, while Clive and Belinda went to the treatment room where Sophie was locked up. Jason was outside, leaning against the wall. He was watching an image being projected on the opposite wall by a small crystal.
How is she?
Belinda asked.
She's trying to pick the lock right now, Jason said. So I'm guessing fine.
He gestured at the wall opposite, and they saw Sophie, from above and behind, hunched over the door lock. The three of them stood looking at the door as five runes lit up around the doorknob.
Five-element lock, Belinda said. Not bad for an internal door.
Jory keeps some expensive supplies in these rooms, Jason said.
Good to know, Belinda said.
Please don't steal them, Jason said.
I don't think she'd do that, Clive said.
No, I would,
Belinda told him. The runes on the door moved until they formed a straight line and the lock clicked. The door opened just enough for Sophie to look out.
Didn't I ask you specifically not to do that? Jason asked.
Sophie groaned in dissatisfaction, but Belinda threw the door wide to ensnare her friend in a huge hug.
I'm so glad you're all right.
You too.
Jason gestured at the room Sophie had just broken out of.
You can talk in there, he said.
Clive, can you do something to the door to stop them opening it up again?
To stop her? He said, nodding at Sophie.
Probably.
Then he gestured at Belinda. To stop her,
Probably not.
Jason groaned.
Just go in and talk, Jason said.
Belinda gently pushed Sophie back into the room, closing the door behind them. She looked around until she spotted the far-seeing crystal Jason had been using to watch the room, floating unobtrusively near the ceiling. She stood up on a chair to take it down and shove it in a drawer.
What was that?
Sophie asked.
He was watching you.
What a creeper.
You did try and break out.
I didn't try. I did break out.
How are you?
I feel all right, Sophie said.
A bit withered on the vine.
Has it really been days?
It has.
Sophie sat in the chair, shuffling to find a posture where the manacles didn't bother her too much. Belinda hopped up to sit on the treatment table.
So, Sophie said, what did they tell you?
Ventress, Magic Society guy, indenture.
The same for me. What are they after?
I'm not sure. According to Asano, he only came after us because someone asked him to. People at the Adventure Society were getting pressured over how long it was taking to catch us.
Do you believe him?
I'm not sure. He seems to be in charge, or at least the others are taking cues from him. He's hard to read, but his partner not so much.
That's the one that caught you?
Yeah. He's all book smarts, more interested in how we did the jobs than the fact we did them. I've been playing along for a couple of days, taking him through stuff as I tease out information. I think Asano knows I'm doing it, but hasn't let the guy know for some reason. Which means he's either on the level or is playing a game his partner doesn't know about.
Could be either, Sophie said.
When I was talking to him, he knew I wouldn't trust him, so he cranked up the shadiness until I didn't know what to think.
So, what's the move?
I don't see any good angles, Sophie said. The deal with Ventress is burned, so even if we get away from these people, the streets aren't safe. We could try the plan to leave the city, but we'd have not much more than food and a map.
Then what?
Belinda asked.
Going along with this guy's plan puts us right into his hands. No way out if he's playing us, or if any of a dozen other things go wrong.
Did they tell you they would let you go? Sophie asked.
Yeah. They said I should stay here, where Ventress and Silver wouldn't dare come for me.
What do you think?
I think the one I'm worried about is you, Soph.
Sophie sighed. We've been running further into the fire for a while now to escape being cooked, Sophie said. It could be that all we have left is to choose who bakes us, if we can choose even that much.
Belinda nodded. I think maybe we take a risk with this guy. Jory and Janice have known him for months. The whole time he's apparently been coming in and healing people for free.
Sounds like he's running some kind of scam.
I know, but Jory sees him as a friend. So does that partner of his, Clive. I know Jory's all right, and I like Clive. He's refreshingly straightforward.
That's not a lot to bet the future on. Belinda hopped down off the table and walked over to Sophie, giving her a reassuring squeeze on the shoulder.
You know why I like Jory? Most people I've met, us included, are out for themselves. Those that don't have are trying to get. Those that have are trying to get more. Jory could have set up shop on the island, selling his alchemy to rich folks, but he didn't. He came here, and he helps people.
He can't be doing too badly, Sophie said. The money to rebuild it all came from somewhere.
It came from Asano, Belinda said, at least according to Janice. Asano just gave Jory the money. No loan, no questions asked.
Why would he do that?
I think, and I'm just guessing here, that Asano looks at Jory the way I do.
With girlish affection?
Shut up. I think he sees someone who helps people. Even the god of healing sees him like that. So why not this guy? And if his response to that is to give Jory money to do it more, how bad can he be?
That's a lot of ifs and guesses, Sophie said.
If you have anything more to work off, this is the time for sharing.
Sophie ran her hands over her face.
It's not much to put myself in the hands of a stranger over.
I think we're already in his hands, Belinda said. It's just a matter of how much we struggle.
So, what do we do?
I think we go along for now, Belinda said.
Those tracking bracelets they give to indentures can't be that hard to beat.
But I won't be the one wearing it, so you decide what we're going to do. I'll back you, whatever it is.
Enter. Arella's voice came through the door, and Jason showed himself into her office. Jason was a little surprised to find the deputy director, also present, sitting behind her own desk.
You met my father, then?
Arella said, as soon as Jason closed the door. He glanced at the deputy director before turning his gaze back to Arella. I did, he said. I like him. He seems to care about you a great deal.
What is it you want in return for silence?
I'm not a blackmailer, director. I would like to avoid any bureaucratic roadblocks in securing the indenture of the thief, but since that will aggravate Lucian Lamprey, that's exactly what you want. And you owe me that much.
I owe you.
You sent people to interfere with my completion of a contract you posted. That's unprofessional. Arella reluctantly nodded.
I'll acknowledge the point, she said.
Who told you about that clause in the service agreement?
I found it myself.
You read it?
Genevieve asked. It was the first time the elderly deputy director had entered the conversation. That's right, Jason told her.
Nobody reads it.
It wasn't that bad, Jason said. You should see legal documents where I come from.
You know, placing yourself between Lucian Lamprey and his objective may not be the safest position,
Arella said, pulling the conversation back on track. Jason turned to look at her. If I don't, who will?
Does it really matter?
I put this woman in a situation where Lamprey can potentially get his claws into her. That makes it my responsibility to see that he doesn't.
Your responsibility?
Yes.
You realize people are placed in horrifying situations every day? She asked.
They aren't my responsibility. Not until I have the power to really change things.
And when you do, what makes you think you know best?
Some things are just obviously wrong, whatever world you come from.
So you're going to come here and tell us right from wrong?
It's easy to excuse away doing nothing, Jason said. It's our tradition, our culture, our values. That does not make it acceptable to hand someone over to a predator.
You're naive,
Arella said.
It's easy to do more harm than good, bumbling around with no idea of the realities.
I've seen the realities, Director. I covered up crimes by a man who tried to have me killed. I did that because the only people who would be hurt if I tried to do something about it would be the victims. Yet this woman I just had locked up in the tower has been hunted for months. Why? For taking things that didn't belong to her. That's the easy excuse that lets a pervert with power claw after her. Thadwick Mercer tried to have me murdered, and the best I can hope for is that his mum tells him off. Every time I kill people in job lots, I get a promotion. But gods forbid a poor person take a rich person's stuff. That's pretext enough to hand them over to whatever filthy lech has the power to demand it. This whole thing was over hunting down the victims, and you're going to tell me I don't know right from wrong.
Are you quite done, Mr. Asano?
Jason let out a tension-relieving sigh. You did ask, he said.
I think we're done here. You can have your thief, Mr. Asano. The agreement with the city is quite clear on this point, and I will see it is enforced. Try not to make more trouble than you have to.
The Adventure Society holding facility was a stone tower. Not the usual green stone, but a dark grey. It saw little use and had little capacity, which is why the Ustai had been penned up in the marshalling yard. Only the Ustai leadership had been held in the tower. An adventurer entered, shoving two surly men in manacles ahead of him. Inside the only door was a small administrative area, where an Adventure Society functionary sat behind protective glass.
"I need to put these two in lockup,"
the adventurer told Albert, the man behind the glass. Albert regularly worked the jobs hall a lot, and had an eye for faces, but he didn't recognize this adventurer. That had been happening a lot lately. With so many people on the expedition, the director had been pressing the more nominal members of the society into service. This adventurer looked more rough and tumble than the usual noble fop, though.
"I'll need to see a copy of the contract they were taken under," Albert told him.
"No contract," the adventurer said. "These two idiots tried to mug the wrong guy."
"If it isn't contract-related," Albert said, "then we can't keep them here. Take them to the courthouse jail."
"I've got stuff to do. Just let me stash them here, and we can sort the rest out later."
"This isn't a hostel," Albert said. "We're not taking them."
"You'd rather I let two hardened criminals loose right here?"
"If you like," Albert said. "We're in the middle of the Adventure Society. If they have half a mind, they'll run like there's a fire behind them."
The adventurer threw Albert a sneer, but dragged the two men away. Around an hour later, he was back. Along with his two prisoners, he had brought Guy Spaulding, the Adventure Society official that was Albert's supervisor.
"Bertinelli," Spaulding scolded Albert. "This adventurer's prisoners need to be taken upstairs."
"Sir, he didn't have a contract."
"I don't care," Spaulding said. "Have them sent up right now."
Albert frowned.
"If you insist, sir. But I'll need to process them first."
"Don't bother with that. Just send them up, on my authority."
"With respect, sir, you have the authority to tell me to do my job. You do not have the authority to tell me not to."
"What? If you know what's good for you, you'll do as I say."
"With respect, sir, I strongly suspect what's good for me is not factoring heavily into your reasoning."
"Are you going to do it or not?"
"No, sir, I am not. It's quite obvious something shady is happening, and I suggest you give it up before you do something that comes back on you."
Spaulding glared at Albert through the glass, then turned on the adventurer who had brought him there.
"Let's go!"
Spaulding barked.
"You're joking,"
the adventurer said to Spaulding.
"I said, let's go."
Shaking his head, the adventurer followed reluctantly. Outside, the adventurer turned on Spaulding.
"What the hell was that? I did what you said and you messed it up twice. Now there's no way to get to the girl quietly."
"Don't talk at me like I'm another one of Silver's lackeys," Spaulding warned.
"A man who gambles as hard and as badly as you," the adventurer said, "should be concerned when he can't keep his promises."
"Don't threaten me," Spaulding said. "Look where you are."
"And how would it go for you if your new director found out how deep in you are?
The world's changing, Spaulding. Being on the take isn't as easy as it used to be. You have to know what you're doing these days, and you've had it too easy for too long. Silver isn't his father, willing to indulge your whims. You need to show us you can adapt to the times, or things are going to get very nasty for you."
Chapter 107. All the Good People We Can Get. The expedition was going island by island, searching for traces of what was disrupting the astral space. They made their first discovery on the third island, a five-sided column, about as tall as a person and covered in magical engravings. One of the adventurers, who was also a member of the Magic Society, examined it, while Danielle Geller hovered nearby.
"Well?"
Danielle asked.
"Definitely some kind of astral magic," the man said. "We could have used Landemir Vane, if someone hadn't gone and killed him. He was a dab hand at this kind of thing. Even Clive Standish would have been a good pick. He's only iron rank, but he knows his astral magic." I didn't pick the expedition members, Danielle said. Complaining about what we don't have isn't productive in any case. What can you tell me?
Not much, the man said. It's a relay for a larger effect. Some kind of astral magic on a very large scale. But I'd need to find a central node to get more. Even then, this isn't like anything I've seen. We need an astral magic specialist.
Danielle scowled. The makeup of the expedition was an absolute mess. Every prominent family in Greenstone wanted to go along, and Elspeth Arella had accepted them all. It was too many people with too little ability, to the point Danielle had wanted to pull out her family's participation entirely. She couldn't convince enough of the family leadership for that, so she ended up agreeing. When things went inevitably wrong, she could at least mitigate the damage if she was present. She did lodge a formal protest over Elspeth Arella's head, however, directly with the Adventure Society's Continental Council.
Large scale, she said, unhappily. Large enough to disrupt a massive desert-spanning astral space?
I would say exactly large enough. If we can find some more of these, I might be able to pinpoint a central node. That might lead us to whoever set all this up.
That's what I like to hear, Daniel said, patting the man on the shoulder. Good work. Jason and Vincent rushed through the Adventure Society campus towards the prison tower. With them were Jory and Belinda, who had hurried from Jory's clinic after Jason sent an anxious message through the voice chat power. The four of them were walking swiftly, not breaking into a run, only to avoid attention. I'm an idiot, Jason said as they marched. I was so impressed with myself. Pure hubris. I stupidly forgot that the most fundamental aspect of corruption is working around the rules, not within them.
I don't know why the director is doing this, Vincent said. She has a number of compelling reasons. Leverage on the Duke, to start with. If one of his judges makes a shady ruling regarding the service agreement between the city and the society, the director gets another arrow in her quiver. Then there's Lucian Lamprey. I bet he was willing to cough up some reforms he couldn't care less about in return for the director going along with it.
But getting rid of corruption is her whole agenda, Vincent said. I don't understand her turning around and using it herself.
I warned you this had the stink of politics, Jason said. She doesn't actually care about eliminating corruption. Cleaning up this branch is just her ticket into the upper ranks of the Adventure Society.
You were right, Vincent said. We just ended up pieces in someone else's game. You only got involved because I asked you.
You were coming from a decent place, unlike Elspeth Arella. We need to look forward. There's no point fretting over what's done.
I'm still unclear on what's happening, Belinda said. Jory just said we had to go and brought me here.
You didn't explain it to me either, Jory said. They spotted the tower. It would have been faster to cut straight across the grass, but Jason steered them onto the more meandering walkway. Stick to the paths, Jason said. We don't want to draw Arella's attention.
She can tell if people are walking on the grass, Belinda asked.
No, but rushing across the grass to the prison tower is something people might pay attention to. The longer before Arella finds out what we're up to, the better.
What are we up to? Jory asked. You said we had to hurry a lot, but never actually said.
Sophie's sentence dispensation hearing is today, Vincent said. She's already been sentenced to indenture, and today is when that indenture gets assigned.
I thought it was being assigned to you, Belinda said to Jason.
The rules are very clear on that, Jason said. Unfortunately, rules only matter so long as they matter to the powerful.
I could have told you that, Belinda said.
Lucian Lamprey has a legal advocate, who will move that because the contract was an open one, the clause in the service agreement with the city doesn't apply, Vincent explained.
Is that how it works? Jory asked.
Not even a little, Jason said. The argument is worthless.
Then what's the issue?
Jory asked.
That's where I come in, Vincent said. The Adventure Society director is powerful.
But she rose up very quickly and doesn't know all the old networks. The Adventure Society's legal advocate, she ordered not to contest Lamprey's court argument, gave me a heads up. The magistrate had also been handled, but that's nothing new. I just don't understand why Arella is working with Lamprey when she's been trying to get rid of him.
Ousting Lamprey was always a means to an end, Jason said. If she can get him to fall into line, that serves her just as well. The sham court ruling is just gravy.
Is the court ruling that bad for the Duke? Jory asked. Can't he just point out that the Adventure Society didn't fight it?
There's 100 ways around that, Vincent said. Arella could claim the Adventure Society didn't see the point of challenging over a minor case. She could throw the advocate under the wagon, claiming incompetence or corruption.
She could have him killed off and claim no one knows what his motivations were, Jason added.
She wouldn't go that far, would she? Vincent asked.
Her father is one of the big three, Jason said. She'd have her dad do it.
Dorgan, Belinda said. He's the father of the Adventure Society's director.
She's been keeping it under her hat for obvious reasons, Jason said.
Should you even be telling us this? Jory asked.
She lost discretion privileges when she lied to my face, Jason said. She told me she would help, then stabbed me in the back as I was congratulating myself over being such a political genius.
They reached the prison tower, Jory and Belinda waiting outside, while Jason and Vincent went in.
Mr. Asano, Albert said, come to check on your prisoner.
I've come to check her out of prison, Bert, Jason said.
Since it was an open contract, Albert said, there's a little extra paperwork. I can release her into the custody of the contracted agent, but with an open contract, you only count as the contracted agent if you're the one that closed it. I'll need the documentation that confirms your status.
Vincent took a folder from his leather satchel, taking out a short stack of documents. He put them down in front of the security screen, pushing them under the narrow slot at the base.
Copy of contract, Albert checked off, leafing through the documents. Confirmation of contract closure. Registration of contract closure. Please hold your badge up against the security screen, Mr. Asano.
No worries, Jason said, taking his badge out and pushing it against the glass window between himself and Albert.
Albert pressed one of the documents against the other side of the glass, and it pulsed briefly with a yellow light.
All in order, Albert continued, and turned back to the papers Vincent had given him. Finally, order of release into custody of contracted agent, which is now officially you, Mr. Asano.
Albert stamped the various forms.
I can hand her over to you, then, sir.
Quickly would be ideal, Bert, Jason said.
I will have to fit her with a tracking bracelet, Albert said. Wouldn't want people just running off, especially a pretty girl like that, sir. You could see how she might turn a man's head. Get him to let her loose against his better judgment.
Perish the thought, Jason said. Fast as you can would be really appreciated.
It was only a few minutes later that Albert, accompanied by an iron rank guard, brought out Sophie. Around her wrist was a simple metal hoop. Jason took out a bottle of the Norwich Distillery's finest, handing it over to Albert.
By way of apology, Jason said.
What for?
For what's going to happen later.
Well?
Danielle asked as Thalia entered the command tent.
Still nothing, Thalia said. That's 2 hours overdue.
Then our scouting team is likely either captured or dead, and we still have no idea who by. How is camp readiness?
Still on alert, but this is a large and undisciplined group. Too many people used to being captain, and not enough willing to be crew. They've been on full alert since the team was due back, and trying to keep them focused for hours at a time is making them inattentive and rebellious.
Damn Arella for handing me all this dross,
Daniel said.
All our good people are wasted keeping an eye on the bad ones. With half the numbers, we'd be twice as effective.
You're too used to only dealing with Gellers,
Thalia said.
You know better than to complain about what you want instead of dealing with what you have.
Danielle flashed her a tired smile.
You're right. Thank you.
So what do we do? We have a missing scout team and fractious troops.
We give them focus, Danielle said. Get ready to mobilize in full force. We're going to find out what happened to our people.
Heading into unknown territory? Potentially against an unknown enemy?
Better than waiting for them to come to us. At least it gives us the initiative.
Suddenly there was an explosion in the camp, followed by yells and screams. Danielle and Thalia went outside to see some kind of automaton army storming the camp. The enemies were not flesh and blood, but built of wood, steel, and stone. The majority were the size and shape of people, but there were towering golems standing 2 or 3 times the height of a person, and even stranger constructions. There was a huge steel spider, on which a figure in robes could be seen. Other robed figures rode similarly outlandish creations, but there were only around 12 robed figures in total, all at the rear of the enemy forces. The pair were nonplussed for only a moment before they started loudly barking orders.
The girl's tracking bracelet?
Arella asked. Not showing up, the deputy director, Genevieve, said. The last location shown was in front of the Cloud Palace.
He's hiding her with Emir Bahadir, Arella mused. No surprise the tracker won't work in there. How strong is that tie?
Asano? With Bahadir? Superficial from what I've been able to gather. The connection is Rufus Ramor.
Can Bahadir be convinced to hand her over?
Unlikely. My read is that Bahadir will keep showing Asano courtesy, at least until Ramor gets back, and he can make another assessment. It might be different if we had something to offer, but that's unlikely. For a gold ranker in this city, wanting and having are the same thing.
Arella tilted her head, her aura sensors picking something up. Trenslow is in the elevator. He may storm out, so go out the side door and be waiting for him when he leaves.
Genevieve nodded, taking the second door into the conference room instead of straight back out to the hall. Vincent arrived outside the director's office, taking a steeling breath.
About time, Trenslow. Arella's voice rang displeasure through the door. Get in here.
Madam Director, Vincent said as he entered. She was seated behind her desk.
Where were you, Trenslow? Did you stop to wax your moustache?
He had, in fact, done exactly that. The long, familiar process calmed him, and he felt better equipped to face the world with it in the best condition. Arella didn't wait for an answer, waving a piece of paper at him.
Would you care to explain why I'm holding in my hand an order placing a prisoner into the personal custody of Jason Asano, issued by you?
You will find that all rules and procedures were followed, Madam Director.
Vincent was putting on a better show of steadfastness than he thought he would manage, but he had no illusions. The director didn't see through it. Arella took a breath and sat back in her chair.
I had thought you were my man, Vincent, she said softly. I thought you agreed with what I was doing.
I did, Vincent said. But then you started cutting corners, hurting the people who wanted to help you. I couldn't understand why, but I was willing to be patient. Now you've shown yourself to be everything you claimed to be fighting against.
Selling a woman to someone like Lucian Lamprey? Don't even try and tell me you don't know what fate awaits her in his hands. With a father like yours, there's no pleading ignorance.
Asano told you, Arella said. I wondered if he would.
He said it won't really hurt you. The things you've done will outshine where you came from. He even thought you chose eradicating corruption as your project for advancement because it plays to the story of rising above your criminal origins.
He's not unintelligent, although far from as smart as he thinks.
Where is he now, Vincent?
I don't know. He said he wasn't going anywhere.
Of course he did. He's arrogant and reckless, running around, believing himself some master manipulator. If it weren't for people not wanting to anger Rufus Ramore and Danielle Geller, he would have been put in the ground months ago. He stood, right where you are, and told me how things were going to go. It never even entered his head that he was being played. You know I'm going to take his membership if he doesn't produce the girl. I hope you told him that.
I guess Lamprey won't keep his end of the deal unless he gets her, Vincent accused.
I'm not looking for your perspective on my affairs, Vincent. You no longer work here. Genevieve is waiting outside to take your official's pin and other accoutrements.
Vincent knew it was coming before he set foot in the building, but it didn't lessen the sting. Without bothering to respond, he turned and walked over to the door.
I didn't tell you to leave, she told him.
He opened the door and paused, without looking back. You just gave up the right to tell me a damn thing, he said.
I thought you were different, that you had integrity.
Just so you know, I don't care who your father is. You're worth hating all on your own. He closed the door behind him, to find the deputy director waiting in the hall as promised. Vincent had always liked the elderly elf. She was stern but fair in her dealings, at least the ones he was privy to. It saddened him to know she was aware of the director's activities. He was taking off his Adventure Society pin and handing it over when a flustered functionary came stumbling out of the elevator and rushed down the hall.
Deputy Director,
the winded woman greeted.
Something's happening with the expedition.
Tell me.
The tracking stones connected to their badges. They're marking people as dying. A lot of iron rankers, but also bronze and even a silver.
Genevieve frowned as she considered briefly, then threw open the door to the director's office.
Inside, Genevieve commanded, and the functionary scuttled in.
She looked at Vincent and pressed the pin back into his hand.
Why? He asked. It sounds like we'll need all the good people we can get.
Chapter 108. You Don't Have the Strength. Emir Bahadir's Cloud Palace was a sprawling, monstrous edifice. Floating just offshore on the north side of the island, it was fully exposed to the waves and currents, yet remained as immovable as solid ground. The entire structure was made from cloud, dyed in colors of blue, purple, orange, and gold. Laid out in multiple wings and towers, it was a fairy tale brought to life. Just walking on the cloud floors gave a sense of serenity, gentle and floating, yet supportive at the same time. Jason and Amir were strolling down a great, long balcony, looking out over the Adventure Society campus.
I can't thank you enough, Jason said. There's no place in the city I can hide her from Elspeth Arella.
This is why I like Outworlders, Emir said.
You have a knack for drawing a large amount of trouble in a small amount of time. Something to do with not recognizing the dangers, perhaps, or simply an unwillingness to waste a second life on caution and worry. It has been my experience that helping an Outworlder in their moments of early need pays off handsomely down the road. 10 years from now, I have no doubt that being owed a favor by you, Mr. Asano, will be a valuable commodity indeed.
You haven't earned a favor here, Mr. Bahadir. You've made a friend, and friends don't count favors. If you need me, I'll be there.
I'm starting to see what Rufus was talking about. I am curious as to why you're throwing away so much for a pair of thieves that, if I'm not mistaken, you hardly know.
I don't really see it as a choice.
Following the balcony to a terrace, they sank into the welcoming embrace of a pair of chairs made of clouds. Jason let out a contented sigh.
I don't think I'll handle going back to regular furniture well.
Emir chortled.
It is easy to become accustomed to the finer things, he said. We must always remember, though, what we do to get them. You were saying that you didn't feel you had a choice.
I was the one who caught this young woman, which makes her disposition my responsibility.
I'm not sure I agree, Emir said. She set out on her own path.
Yes, because orphans with a debt to a crime lord have so many options in life. If you placed someone in the hands of a filthy degenerate, would you feel that your own hands were clean?
I suppose not. I'm not sure I'd go so far to protect them, though.
A responsibility isn't just a responsibility so long as it's convenient, Jason said. I can live with burning bridges if the bridges are rotten. If I lose my society membership, so be it.
My understanding is that you did everything according to the rules, Emir said, outside of losing the young lady in your custody, of course. But incompetence is not grounds for expulsion. I would expect a demotion, however. Do you have your second star?
And a third, Jason said. But I'm wondering how much of that was to keep me distracted. I imagine I'll be left with just the one when this is over.
I think, perhaps, it is coming on time to put Greenstone behind you, Mr. Asalo. Has Rufus broached the idea of joining him when he returns to Vitesse?
He has, Jason said. That said, he still has work to do here.
Yes, he does. I will be here a little while, and he should be returning with me. Allow me to extend that invitation to you and the young woman taking sanctuary here. I believe a new city, far away, is exactly what they need.
From what they've been willing to tell me, that was very much the plan, until I intervened. I did have another thought about how to keep Miss Wexler out of Lucian Lamprey's grasp.
Oh?
Elspeth Arella can hand Lamprey a thief, and no one will care less. If she tried to hand over an adventurer, though.
You want to make this girl an adventurer?
Why not? She's a lot more ready for it than I was. She's probably more ready than I am now. I've pulled together money enough that I can afford some low-rarity essences at auction. There's one in a few days, and I'm hoping the absentees let me get a good price.
Finding the essences is not the largest obstacle to that course of action.
But it is an obstacle. You go through walls one at a time, Mr. Bahadir.
You mean over walls?
I use my words with care, Mr. Bahadir. Emir laughed.
You certainly run full speed at a problem, Mr. Asano. The perspective of youth.
At a glance, Emir didn't look to be more than 30 years old. There was an agelessness to him, however, that Jason had seen to a lesser degree in Danielle Geller and Thalia Mercer. Most of Greenstone's other silver rankers showed more of their age.
I would hold off on that auction, Emir suggested. With patience, opportunity may find you.
That's right, Jason said, remembering something. Farah told me not to rush to pick up my last awakening stones. I got the impression it was something to do with what sent them here in the first place, but they wouldn't tell me more. I assume that's why you're here as well.
Indeed, I am. I've been looking for something for some time, across seas and continents. It's what I do. People know that something exists somewhere, and they pay me to find it. And they pay well. Usually it's long-time gold or even diamond rankers. The interests of those who live for centuries are far-reaching, sophisticated, and esoteric.
You work for diamond rankers?
I do. Not many people have met so many as I, let alone be given the chance to perform a service. They pay in more exotic currency than mundane coins.
Like castles made out of clouds?
Exactly like that. You know, Mr. Asano, if your attempts to convince people to kill you don't pan out, I think I can find some work for you, once you rank up once or twice.
I'm not sure I'm willing to wait around for months while you check false leads. Rufus and his team are convinced what you're looking for is here, presumably somewhere more intact than that complex out in the swamps.
Yes, it was disappointingly empty of content. Did you happen to take anything?
We took some combat dummy parts. My friend wanted to reassemble them.
Did he?
Not yet.
So what is this mysterious event you have coming up?
Another complex, like I found, but more intact? I imagine going untouched for centuries would mean a good chance at essences and the like, with no one wandering through to nab them. Clive said we were unlucky not to come across any in our find.
I really shouldn't say more at this point, but you are on the right track. There are some unusual nuances to the exploration that mean I will require local assistance, which should be lucrative for everyone involved, from what I've been able to put together, anyway.
Tantalizing, Jason said. You're certain I can't tease more out of you?
I've said more than I should already. After all, don't they say the anticipation is better than the meal?
Only if all the cooks they know are terrible. One of Emir's staff approached them. From Jason's limited experience, Emir's people were an eclectic and casual bunch, but that did not extend to his chief of staff, Constance. The silver anchor was Emir's right hand and exuded professionalism each time Jason encountered her.
Sir, Elspeth Arella is at the entrance and has asked to see you.
She's here personally, not a messenger.
In person, sir, yes.
I'll be right down then.
Constance nodded and left, Emir wistfully watching her depart.
I'm rather desperately in love with that woman, he said wistfully. She wants nothing to do with me, of course. She has seen me at my worst.
She's aware of your affections?
Oh, yes.
She's still working for you, which is a good sign. I imagine she would have no problem making her way in the world outside of your employ.
Very much so. I have no idea why she stays with me, except for the pay, and the travel, and the accommodations.
He sighed.
I'd best go see to the branch director, he said. Care to come along? You haven't seen her since before you absconded here, have you?
I haven't, Jason said. I don't see the problem with tagging along.
Sophie and Belinda were in an opulent two-bedroom guest suite. The entire wall in front of them had turned into mist, allowing them to look out over the ocean as they relaxed in plush cloud chairs.
I don't understand what's happening anymore, Belinda said.
Those cloud beds!
I've never slept like that in my life.
A week ago, we were wondering if we'd still be alive right now, and look at this.
It's nice, Sophie said. But what is Asano's goal? What does he get out of bringing us here?
Maybe he really is just trying to help us, Belinda said. That drew a flat look from Sophie.
Yeah, Belinda said. It sounded stupid as I was saying it.
Constance was waiting for Emir and Jason at the palace exit that connected to the shore by a cloud path. Emir marched across the walkway with Constance and Jason flanking him. Elspeth Arella waited on shore, alone.
If your goal is to convince me to disgorge my guests, Emir said without preamble, then I'm afraid you're wasting your time.
That can wait,
Arella said, not sparing Jason so much as a glance.
The expedition your fellow Vitesse adventurers are on, there's been a problem.
What kind of problem? Emir asked.
Less than an hour ago, its members started dying. All we have is their tracking stone, so we don't know anything else, but we've lost a silver ranker, multiple bronze rankers, and a slew of irons. Everyone we could use to send support in time is already on the expedition, so I'm here to ask if you or your people can help.
Emir frowned unhappily, Jason matching his expression.
Constance? Emir asked.
Hester has been to a number of areas in the region. I can see how close she can get us.
Do it, and ready the field team,
Emir ordered. The usual undertone of casual amusement was absent from his voice. Constance immediately marched back towards the palace.
I want to be a part of this, Jason said. You don't have the strength, Emir said. Protecting you would cost us more than having you would help.
I know an alchemist with a stockpile of medical supplies and connections with the healer.
We could set up a recovery station outside the astral space while you go in and get them.
Emir gave Jason an assessing look, then nodded.
How fast can you get things together?
I can lend him some Adventure Society authority to speed things along, Arella said. I'll have your friend Vincent meet you.
He still has a job?
He does today.
Chaos reigned as the expedition campsite was attacked. There were very few living people amongst the attackers, all of whom were silver or bronze rank. Their features couldn't be seen under sandy-colored robes, not even race. Only their auras gave away their nature as living beings. The bulk of the enemy force were construct creatures that varied wildly in design. There were creatures like wooden puppets, awkward but numerous. Lumbering stone golems walked amongst them, as large as 2 or 3 times the size of a human. There were strange creatures made of complicated interconnecting parts. Some were the size and shape of people, others were more animal-like, some serving as mounts for the robed people. Behind them all was a towering behemoth of stone and metal, a 10-meter-tall, spider-shaped steel behemoth. It apparently had been held back so as not to alert the camp before the surprise attack. As such, it was still making its way forwards from a distance. Danielle quickly discovered there was no ordering the chaos. All she could do was find key people and try to direct them where they were needed most. In between, she stepped onto the field herself. She wanted to go after the robe wearers she assumed were controlling the construct army, but too many people needed help against the artificial horde. She paced herself, knowing her own limits. In a short fight, she was confident against any opponent, but her powerful abilities would exhaust her mana quickly. Aside from conjuring her dimension blade, she relied on skills and silver rank attributes to mow through weaker enemies. She saved her most exhausting powers for critical moments when the difference was life and death. Around the battlefield, the more capable adventurers had reached similar conclusions to Danielle and were doing their best to help the others. Those that knew their abilities well and how to use them picked their targets accordingly. Thalia Mercer plowed through crowds of constructs like a bowling ball, enemies bouncing away without slowing her down. She focused on the golems, which were big, slow, and either bronze or silver rank. The bronze ones barely slowed her down, exploding into stone shrapnel as she literally smashed through them with shoulder charges. For the silvers, 3 times her height or more, she would rip off a limb and break the rest of the body apart by using it as a club. Farah and Gary had recruited Beth Cavendish and her team. Farah had encased herself in obsidian armor and conjured a huge obsidian sword. The blade was not a blade at all, but a pillar of jagged segments, like horrible teeth. The segments could break up and whip around on a cord of glowing magma. She swept it around, burning and breaking apart the constructs. Mixing in devastating lava spells, she used her abilities to create space for weaker expedition members to fall back. Into that space, walls of metal and stone rose out of the ground to form barricades. This was the combined efforts of Gary and Hudson, the human frontliner who was almost as large as Gary. The other members of Beth's team cleaned up any loose ends, while Beth used spell after spell to keep feeding mana to Farah. Her potent abilities were costly and hard to maintain as the battle dragged on, while Beth desperately replenished her as fast as she could. Rufus, in the meantime, was flickering through the enemy like a ghost. He appeared and disappeared in rapid succession, moving unhindered. In his hand was a silver sword, under which constructs fell as he passed. These were simple humanoid forms, mostly wood on a metal frame. They were essentially combat dummies, without the safety features. These were only incidental targets, however. His primary targets were the less common construct creatures, which were many and varied. They were larger than the humanoid for the most part, and had been built to mimic various animals and monsters. In addition to being larger and tougher than their wooden, humanoid brethren, they were also faster and smarter. Where the others shuffled along with zombie-like shambling as they sought out living enemies, their forms very much followed function. Rufus tracked a specific one, a giant tiger made of intricate steel cogs. The bronze-rank clockwork cat was faster than its simple brethren, wreaking havoc amongst the expedition's panicking iron rankers, even claiming some of the bronze. Rufus stopped his rapid vanishing run. He dropped the conjured silver sword, and a golden one appeared in its place. The cat locked its unliving gaze on him and launched into a high pounce. Its speed, so terrifying to the iron rankers,
was as good as standing still to Rufus. As Rufus activated his speed of light power, the world seemed to freeze in time around him. The creature was stuck, mid-pounce, hovering in the air. The power only afforded Rufus 2 seconds of accelerated time, and he wasted none of it. He ran under the creature, pushing his peak bronze rank reflexes to the limit, as he lashed out 4 times with his golden sword. Every movement left a trail of golden light in his wake. Rufus returned to the normal passage of time, and the cat was once again hurtling to the spot Rufus had just disappeared from. The golden trail showed every movement he had made in his accelerated time, but it did the cat no good. It landed, vulnerable, on the ground, each of its limbs cleanly severed. The severed limbs all glowed with golden heat where Rufus's sword had passed through. The creature landed helpless on the ground, limbs scattered around. Rufus plunged his sword into its head, sinking it to the hilt. Then he ran the sword down the length of its body, leaving a trail of hot metal as he sliced it clean in half. He left his sword buried in the clockwork cat, conjuring a new silver one and vanishing. Danielle kept an eye on the battlefield as a whole. They weren't turning the fight, but their key people were sending the unintelligent automatons into an increasing state of disarray. It was enough that she could start organizing a withdrawal. In one corner of the battle, some of her people had erected barricades she could use as a launch point for the retreat. The trick would be holding the rest of the line as she wrangled those behind it. She spread out her aura sensors, looking for the expedition leaders she would need to make it happen. Chapter 109. The Tyranny of Rank. The retreat was going worse than Danielle had hoped, but better than she feared. The iron rankers had been pulled back behind the bronze and silver rankers holding the line. Luckily, the other side had only a few essence users, their number made up mostly of constructs. The artificial creatures were not the match of an equal rank essence user, but there were so many that they made up the difference. The enemy essence users were also reluctant to risk themselves by engaging directly, which helped Danielle's attempts to pull circumstances under her control. They were not out of danger as the enemy continued to press, but the constructs were paying for their aggression. Pushing mindlessly against the increasingly ordered withdrawal formation, they were being rapidly ground up. They were unrelenting, however, the unliving constructs having no morale to lose. There was not a lot of open space in the rainforest, but a battle line had managed to form in the now destroyed remains of the expedition camp, which had been cleared of trees using essence abilities. That made for a relatively open field in which the defense was holding, while the rest of the expedition retreated into the trees. The battlefield was slowly shifting. The initial attack had sown chaos and death amongst the adventurers, most of their casualties coming in those early minutes. The battle slowly started to shift as the strongest adventurers came to the fore, and the expedition leadership managed to give the defenses some semblance of order. Once a rough but definite battle line was established, the construct creatures were being ground to pieces against it. The rescue expedition formed up in the marshalling yard. Emir gave out directions, breaking the group into an incursion team and a support team. After that, he directed one of his people, a woman named Hester, to open a portal. She traced a circle in the air, which started shimmering, revealing an image of a city on the far side. Emir stepped through alone, and the portal collapsed, only powerful enough to send one gold ranker through. The others would have to wait for the ability to come off cooldown before they could follow. Hester was the closest Jason had seen to another Asiatic person in this world. He chatted with her as they waited for her portal ability to become available again. She told him she could only open the portal to places she'd previously visited, which was normal for long-range teleport abilities. The closest place to the aperture the expedition had traveled was a city to the north called Boko. The first task of the expedition had been to return the Ustai to the northern territories in their monstrous sand barge. The city of Boko was where the Adventure Society decided to return the Ustai slaves, along with any women and children that had wanted out of the tribe. Many had been seized from small communities in the region in the first place. The time between uses for Hester's power was based on range. At the distance between Greenstone and Boko, it would be available again after an hour, one of several limitations.
The more powerful the people going through the portal, the fewer people could use it before it collapsed. Hester was silver rank, but her portal ability had already reached gold. This was the only reason her portal could transmit the gold-ranked Emir at all. Emir would spend the hour requisitioning vehicles from the local Magic Society branch. Everyone else would go through the second portal Hester raised, including the silver and bronze rankers Arella had rounded up. Unlike the initial expedition, these were the best Greenstone had left to offer, the top people from every family. They were all ready to go and rescue their family members, with no shirking or hesitation among them. The support team included Jory, a number of priests from the Church of Healer, plus various other volunteers with healing abilities. Rounding out the numbers were Adventure Society functionaries and officials going along to provide general support and assistance. Unless there were a lot of afflictions going around, that would be Jason's role as well. The defensive formation of the expedition's retreating forces was built around key people who served as anchors for the less powerful. Silver rankers had arrayed themselves against the strongest opponents, but there were not enough silver rankers to go around. The rest of the line had to make do with groups of more powerful bronze rankers. One such location had Farrah, Rufus, and Gary working in synergy to keep the enemy at bay as the other adventurers withdrew. Farrah wreaked havoc on the main mass of the enemy, while Gary and Rufus intercepted the more powerful threats trying to stop her. Farrah had conjured for herself obsidian armor that glowed with internal heat. Gary conjured something similar, made of iron, becoming an immovable bulwark. Rufus was the unstoppable force to Gary's immovable object, dancing around stalled enemies as his golden sword carved through them. The enemy leadership had thus far remained at a secure distance, riding their strange construct mounts and hidden under hooded robes. Finally, they acted when the battlefield conditions started to shift. They simultaneously leapt into the fray, striking out at crucial points in the defensive line. The enemy leaders were all bronze and silver rankers, and their intervention pressured several critical points in the line. A figure covered in robes moved on Farrah. Rufus saw it coming, gesturing at Gary, and they rushed to intercept. It had a silver rank aura, and its robes were filled with a strange bulk. Its movements were strange, its arms hanging limply at its sides. It lunged forwards with a kick, Gary stepping up to intervene. He had a huge hammer in one hand and a shield in the other, which he raised in front of him. Expertly, Gary angled his shield to deflect most of the kick's force. In spite of his huge strength, he was still sent stumbling backwards with a large dent in his shield. Gary's speed and strength were at the very peak of what a bronze ranker could achieve, being the equal of most low-ranker silvers. Their enemy was as high in silver as Gary and Rufus were in bronze, so even Gary was heavily overmatched. Rufus moved in to attack, quickly recognizing that the arms hanging at the enemy's sides seemed to be crippled. It fought with kicks alone, moving and spinning with a speed bordering on gold rank. Kicks alone were not an efficient means of fighting, however, and as Gary came back to the fore, they teamed up to attack. As they battled the silver ranker, Farrah was hard at work holding the line. The adventurers around them were bronze and not as strong as her and her companions. They did not make up for holding the line in place of Gary and Rufus, giving the pair a wide berth as they battled the silver. The robed enemy was being pushed by Gary and Rufus, largely due to using neither essence abilities nor its arms. Their attacks seemed to have little impact, however, as the bulk in the robes was apparently some kind of armor. It seemed to shrug off every attack that landed. There was a brief balance, Gary and Rufus with all their abilities against the robed figure that only kicked. That balance was abruptly broken, with a powerful kick getting past Gary's shield and landing square on the torso of his heavy armor. The armor deformed into his chest as he was sent tumbling across the ground, ribs shattered. Only his bronze rank toughness and his heavy armor kept him alive. But he wasn't getting back up. When their turn came, Jason and Jory walked up to the portal. They glanced at each other and stepped through. There was a rushing sensation that came with moving through the portal that felt just like his teleport ability. After they emerged, Jory staggered off and fell to his knees, throwing up. Looking around, Jason saw that Jory wasn't alone. Many people had been unsettled by it. Jason noticed others that, like him, were unaffected, and most of them were members of the Celestine race.
He remembered that his astral affinity racial gift was one he shared with Celestines, which apparently gave a tolerance for teleporting. The city of Boko reminded Jason of Old City, with plenty of desert stone in evidence. The air was drier here, without the proximity of the delta and the ocean. Just breathing was drying out his mouth. He didn't have time to look around, though, as there was work to be done. Amir had used his hour head start effectively, leaving sand skimmers waiting to carry them into the desert. Rufus was now facing the Silver Ranker alone. He didn't have Gary's reflexes, but his skill was a level above their enemy. The robed figure followed the kick to Gary with one aimed at Rufus, who read the move in time to narrowly avoid it. Rufus used his speed of light power, one of his strongest trump cards. Everything appeared to freeze around him, even his incredibly fast enemy. In this brief moment of grace, he lashed out multiple times against the robed figure. Even with his enemy at a standstill, Rufus's golden sword had little impact on the armor hidden under the enemy's bulky robes. Even a strike straight to the head bounced off, eerily without a clang in the moments outside of time. His power lasted only a scant pair of seconds, Rufus inwardly cursing as it was wasted on cutting holes in the enemy's robe. Time started moving at normal speed once again. The robes were torn and burned by Rufus's glowing golden sword, the rents revealing metal underneath. The remains of the robes were suddenly shredded as something burst from within, giving Rufus his first look at his attacker's true form. The protection Rufus's blade had struck was no external armor, but metal grafted directly into flesh. Steel pushed into skin, heavy bolts using bones for anchor points. It was an abomination of living tissue and cold steel. Even its head had plates bolted into the skull. Barely any flesh was visible under all the metal, just the jaw and some patches around the joints. There wasn't even enough living flesh to tell if it was a man or a woman. There were four wholly artificial arms emerging from its back, long and inhuman. They were articulated at multiple points and were crafted from razor-sharp metal. They ended in oversized hands, each finger tapered to a point like a cluster of spearheads. The arms had been wrapped around the enemy's body, the source of the bulk under its robes. It was releasing these arms that had torn the robes asunder. The enemy's natural arms continued to hang limply as their metal equivalents flexed power.